Hi, ActiveHistory.ca is happy to feature a recording of The War of 1812, Whose War Was It Anyway? A Roundtable Discussion. The event was held at the Waterloo Public Library on May 30th, 2012, and was organized by the Active History CHA Committee. Thanks to the History Education Network, Histoire et Education en Réseau, for their generous financial support, and the Canadian Historical Association for their assistance in extending funding and promotional space.
Good evening. Thanks, Peggy, for the introduction, and thank you very much to also Jamie and everyone involved in Active History for the invitation to moderate the conversation here this evening. And welcome to everybody. I mean, it's great to see this wonderful turnout. I was just talking to Jamie. We had no idea how many people would show up in this room. And it's, you know, if there were rafters, we'd be packed to them, wouldn't we? I imagine I speak for everyone when I say I'm really looking forward to everyone's comments as this evening progresses. My own work underway on this war, I'd like to explain very briefly, so you, in the interest of, I guess, full disclosure, in the interest of where my work fits in the spectrum of views that we have represented at this impressive and exciting table. During war, I argue or assume or base my understanding on, let's hope it's true, during war, a society articulates its terms of social inclusion and membership with acute clarity. People get really, really clear about who belongs, right? And about who doesn't belong. And this is particularly so, I think, for colonial societies like Upper Canada's during the War of 1812 that are complicated by issues of indigeneity and are complicated by issues of heterogeneity. People look different, people practice different religions, people are from different spaces and places in the world and trying to get along together. Currently, and I'm massively generalizing, but currently, historians interpret the War of 1812, and many of you know this, as a pivotal event that created a Canadian nation and created a sense of Canadian nationhood. And this interpretation is explicit in the old War of 1812 display at the Canadian War Museum. And I haven't seen the new display, but I bet it hasn't changed a whole lot, given this government's take on the War of 1812 and its meanings. Instead of that view, my understanding of the colonial Canadas embraces a much more fluid sense of public identity. And I'm interested in how the war compelled the colony's very, very different peoples to express how each belonged in their own unequal, but also completely unpredictable ways to that society and to its public life and to its public culture. And I just want to read to you some voices from 1812 to indicate the extreme diversity of participants in this war and members of this colonial society at war. For example, the Anishinaabe tell of spying on an American fort, and I'm quoting a lot through here, I'm not going to do this every time, okay? So, the story goes, five Anishinaabe warriors were asked to investigate, and those men became bats, and they flew off. All gave the same report. That's how many tents there are, that's how many guns there are up front. Here's a different voice. A government administrator reported how the Western Indians joined us at the head of the lake. Nearly 4,000 men, women, and children. A different voice, a U.S. officer this time, says he saw among the British Allied casualties but one of their Indians and one Negro with the Glengarry uniform dead on the field. A militia captain wrote after a battle, that, quote, the women collected in groups in every public place. Women spoke of the toll of war upon their household economies. So, for example, we have Sarah Clark writing into the government to get money back for, quote, a quantity of kitchen furniture taken away by the United States Army. We have Elizabeth Stull claiming £2 for a crock of butter, a large crock of butter. And Margaret Wilson reported 2 cows killed and taken. One soldier recalled, this is terrible, quote, being much affected by seeing and hearing a lad about 11 or 12 years of age, wounded in one of his knees, crying for his dear mother. He was a midshipman. Subaltern John Le Couture confessed that he and his men all burst into tears together upon hearing the toll of death read out loud to them after a battle. In war news, the Buffalo Gazette reported the situation of the poor class of the Canadian people as truly distressed, and so on and on and on. We can hear many, many, many of these voices. And the point is that these are diverse words. They represent many wars of 1812. The words are from warriors, they're from housewives, they're from soldiers, they're from officials, and taken together, they raise issues pertinent to understanding this colonial society and this war of 1812. They raise issues of racialized identity, and they raise those issues both in an indigenous language that emphasizes powerful ability, but also in a colonialist language that presumes this kind of white prerogative to judge, right? They speak to issues of gender and position women and First Nations families within the context of a public that granted white men and boys unquestioned privilege there, although it was, you know, subverted a lot. They speak of boys as soldiers and address the meanings of the masculine, and they address issues of class. So taken together, all these words mean that the colony's peoples are thinking about their public. They're thinking about their wars, their war. They're thinking about how this war was fought by each of them and what it meant for each of them. And they're expressing this in the kinds of language that they had available. So in a way, I think, you know, whose war it was, to quote the title of the session this evening, it kind of depends on whose voice we're listening to. And I imagine that's the perspective which will come from many of our speakers. So, as we gather here under the auspices of the Active History Group thinking about 1812, we can also be asking questions about our own contemporary understandings of our society, about who belongs, who doesn't belong, issues of cultural membership, and so on. And we'll still be kind of close to the way peoples of 1812 were thinking about their war, too, because they were worried about the very same things that we're worried about. So, with that introduction, let's begin. We are fortunate to have a group here of researchers and writers and speakers with diverse views on the War of 1812 and its particularly of its commemoration. Some of these views will no doubt, and hopefully, be perceived by some others as contentious, controversial, challenging, and I hope for and anticipate a fulsome exchange of ideas, opinions, and knowledge, and a lively question and answer session towards the end of the evening. My role here, hopefully, is to stop talking really, really soon. I'm going to introduce each speaker one at a time, but I see my role here much the way I do in my undergraduate sort of seminars and tutorials. My role is to facilitate, but not to interject. My role is hopefully, in the end, to referee, because things, you know, get lively, and I'm just going to point things in certain directions and move them. After a bit, we want this. And this is your space, and your space to speak and to think. And it's a respectful space, to be sure, one in which we engage with civility and openness with each other's perspectives. So the format for the evening. The session has three parts. The first will be brief opening remarks by each speaker after I introduce each speaker, roughly 5 to 10 minutes each, though I understand one is 12. panelists. The second will be a session or section of moderated exchange initiated by me, but I'm thinking it will take off on its own after that. And the third section will be a question and answer session from you to the panelists. I don't know what these speakers are going to speak on. So I'll listen hard and try to come up with some good questions to initiate discussion while people are talking. So I'm going to introduce each panelist one at a time just before each speaks, and I will do that now unless we have any questions. Okay. The first speaker this evening is Catherine Emerson. She is a Niagara County, New York historian, a post she has held since 2006. For the past 30 years, she has worked at various historic sites and museums in both curatorial and educational capacities. She holds a master's degree in American history from Boston University, which included a curatorial internship at Old Sturbridge Village. Some of her other research and publications include topics as varied as Pennsylvania German clothing during the colonial era, colonial foodways, particularly those of the Germans and the French. In 1981, Catherine served on a cannon crew with the Royal American Regiment out of Fort Pitt, and that provided her with her predilection for seeking out Betsy Doyle's story, a parallel story to that of another War of 1812 heroine of Canadian fame.
Laura Sarsfield.
Thank you. And those of other female artists. Catherine.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's an honor to be here, albeit I must say it's a little daunting as I'm the only American and only New York licensed lady out there. I'm a public historian. I am appointed by the Niagara County, New York legislature, and I am obligated by law to promote, protect, publish, preserve, collect, and commemorate county history. We are also to assist and collaborate with museums, historical associations, educational groups, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, in promoting Niagara County heritage. Our archives is more of a library, and so what happens is we end up facilitating and supporting other groups as they do stuff. We do write articles and public programs and things like that, but we're not really the movers, if you get what I mean. To this end, I found myself about 2 years ago having to do something about the bicentennial of the War of 1812. Now, in school, the conflict was covered in, maybe three paragraphs, a sandwich between the framing of the Constitution and the Jeffersonian Greenback controversy of 1837. And college wasn't a whole lot different. So here I was, contemplating a relatively unknown topic. What happened next was totally unexpected, and no one ever imagined that we would solve an old mystery and uncover a story so compelling and so surprisingly controversial. Now, civilians traditionally are passive participants to the vicissitudes of armies jockeying for position and hegemony. They react to situations as opposed to be directly involved with little or no say. You know, women for millennia have been the victims of these invading armies, and they usually hunker down and wait for some sort of status quo to emerge. Now, two women during the War of 1812 in the Niagara region stepped out of their accepted roles, and that's Laura Secord and Betsy Doyle. Politics aside, both women reached out of their traditional spheres to defend themselves, their families, their communities, and their countries. Laura conducted a perilous hike through woods, with or without a cow, and crossed hostile picket lines to deliver information to James Fitzgibbons. Whether her account held vital new intelligence or not really isn't the critical piece. The fact that she took matters into her own hands and she walked a fair distance to deliver her report stands to a testimony to her determination. Laura Secord's no wimp, and she makes great chocolate, so hey, what can you say? Now, Betsy Doyle is the other woman who did not let circumstances dictate her actions. Many on both sides of the border do not know her story or even her true name. Often she has been erroneously referred to as Fanny Doyle. Don't let me hear you call her that. Betsy and her husband Andrew, in many ways, highlight the American experience in World War II. Yeah, where am I? The War of 1812. And until recently, both were really enigmas. Andrew was a member of the 1st U.S. Artillery, and he was captured at the Battle of Queenston in October of 1812. From there, along with Lieutenant Colonel Winfield Scott and other POWs, he was transferred onto ships, and they were sent to Quebec with the idea that they would end up in Boston, paroled and exchanged. But while they were lying at anchor there at Quebec, General Prevost sent officers to interrogate the prisoners. You see, the British government did not recognize American naturalization. Once a subject of the king, always a subject of the king. Irish and Canadian-born soldiers were culled out of this group and charged with treason. The intention was to send them to England for trial and subsequent hanging. Winfield Scott tried to intervene for 23 that were already picked out of the group, but to no avail, and Andrew was one of those. And along with these 23, he was sent to England. Meanwhile, Winfield Scott goes back to Washington, D.C., and reports this incident. And Madison and the Secretary of War, in turn, talk to the British and say, you took 23 of our guys, so we're going to take 23 of yours. And the Brits say, well, you take 23 of ours, so we're going to take 46 of yours. And the Americans go, well, if you're going to take 46 of ours, we're going to take 92 of yours. And pretty soon they sound like second graders, you know, brawling on the playground. As idiotic as it does two things. One, no more American citizens were taken or impressed by the British on the pretext of being deserters or treasonous subjects. And two, our 23 POWs taken in Quebec were never brought to trial. They were kept on prison ships and moved to Dartmoor Prison, but they suffered from neglect, not persecution. After the war, in August of 1815, Andrew Doyle arrived in Boston and eventually settles down as a good farmer in Swansea, Massachusetts. Now, it's no secret that he was born in St. David's, Upper Canada, a fact borne out by numerous U.S. federal and state census and by his own Army enlistment papers. What was not revealed until his death in 1883 was his parentage. His maternal grandfather, Andrew Summers, who he's named after, had emigrated to the Schoharie Valley in New York. And during the American Revolution, he joins MacDonnell's company of King's Royal New Yorkers. The guy's a Tory. He serves at Catoctin, and while there, his daughter Catherine meets and marries a Benjamin Doyle. Doyle is an Irishman and, oh, this is even better, he's a member of Butler's Rangers, and he's stationed at Fort Niagara. In 1797, they are living in the Princeton, Blenheim, Burford area around here in Upper Canada. And the whole family, you know, receives land for their loyalty to the king. And one of Andrew's sisters actually marries a sea court. Yeah, no wonder Andrew kept his parentage quiet. Okay, so what of his wife, Betsy? We don't know her maiden name, and we do not know where she came from. We only know that she served as a laundress or a nurse at Fort Niagara. Shortly after the Battle of Queenston, on November 21st, 1812, a cannonade commenced between Fort Niagara on one side of the Niagara River and Fort George on the British bank. It went on for over 12 hours, and the noise was heard as far south as Buffalo. This is where Betsy achieves her initial fame. She carried hot shots of the guns on top of the old mess house. Today it is known as the French Castle if you all go to Fort Niagara. Now, what this involved, what she was doing, she was carrying cherry red hot 6-pound iron balls up 2 or 3 floors to the piece on the top. With tongs in skirts. She didn't have to go to the gym the next day, that's for sure. Colonel McFeely, commanding Fort Niagara, likened her actions to Joan of Arc in both his journal and his official reports. Now, up until recently, no one knew what happened to Betsy after this incident. Tales of the escapade were written up in the 40s, and that's when they started to call her Fanny, who was married to Tom, the only son of a widowed mother. Ugh. Donald Graves, you know, your Canadian military historian, actually discovered a reference to her that was dated May 1813, when a young American officer wanted to see this Joan of Arc and was sadly disappointed with the all-too-human Betsy. I think Betsy should probably start a cosmetic company. That's another story. One benefit of the commemoration of the War of 1812, and it's a big one, has been the digitization and indexing of the records in the National Archives and other repositories. Without this, we would have not known the fate of Betsy Doyle, and she would still remain a mystery. The evening before Fort Niagara was overrun by British troops, Betsy tried to encourage the militia, who were rather timid, by putting on the coat and accoutrements of a sentry and taking her turn standing guard at the fort on a very cold and very raw December night. 24 hours later, she and her children were literally running for their lives from the enemy British and their Indian allies. I don't know precisely what road they took. I can only surmise. We know she could not go south because the enemy had landed below the fort and were making their way south towards Lewiston and eventually Buffalo and environs. Betsy had to go east. Like others, the family probably made for Batavia, finding help where they could along the way. From there, we know she went from Batavia to Canandaigua to Utica to East Greenbush, a trip over 310 miles across New York State in the winter through the snow belt with children. I don't like doing it today in the car with, anyway. East Greenbush is located south and east of Albany. It's almost on the Connecticut border, and it was the main supply depot for the American Army in the Northeast. According to Colonel Simon Larned, Betsy and her children arrived there in April 1814, a three-month trip, and he called her a worthy and industrious woman. 4 years later, Lieutenant Henry Smith at East Greenbush reported her death on April 2nd. He considered her a conscientious worker despite the fact that she had not been paid in over a year. She died believing Andrew, too, had died. And we think that he must have felt the same because he remarried in 1819. For too long, the story of Betsy and Andrew has been full of mistaken history, mistaken identity, and Victorian embroidery. In my zeal to achieve some recognition for them, and due in part to my warped sense of humor, I stated in my article that Betsy made Laura's trek to the Beaver Dams look like a summer stroll in the park. Hey, I didn't say Rock was a cross-dresser. But anyway, for this I have been raked over the coals by Canadian newspapers from Vancouver to Ottawa. And that really wasn't my intention. No one read past that sentence and into the rest of the article. Both women were heroines. Betsy is heretofore the lesser known and less documented, but I simply wanted to get her story out. We need heroines in petticoats. There are so few narratives concerning women, and the other overlooked group is that of the prisoners. So the story of the Doyles really embodies both, plus you have the whole Civil War aspect between the two countries going on in this one family. That said, I am a historian, and I'm about to be a heretic. The commemoration of the War of 1812 is about history, or at least it should be. I have too often seen activities that negate, forget, or belittle it. Please, someone, I keep asking, can you tell me how a peace garden differs from my garden? Except maybe weeds? Modern historians, we are the Bards, we are the McGids, we are the Shawnakes of our culture, handing down its history and its traditions. Our objective should be to make history alive, to make it interesting. I really don't care who won the War of 1812. Frankly, that debate is like discussing how many angels can fit on the head of a pin. It makes us look petty, boring, and irrelevant. I'm getting too excited here. History provides a window into the past, and it gives us an understanding of our present-day situation, and how individuals and nations and the global community might develop and interact in the future. In short, the study of the past helps lead to a greater personal insight and a comprehension of our place in the grand sweep of the human story. We do ourselves and those around us a disfavor by not taking this wonderful, great opportunity to teach, research, and explain. How else do we get others interested? If I can get a few more people carefully looking at their history, at seeing it in a new way or in a different light, then I feel I've really done my job. And like it or not, to quote Abraham Lincoln, fellow citizens, we cannot escape history. Thank you.
Our next speaker is James Elliott. James is a Canadian journalist and an author with a keen and abiding interest in early North American history. With the Hamilton Spectator, he wrote widely on the War of 1812 on subjects ranging from the Bloody Assizes to the Burlington Races. He worked on several episodes of the CBC's Gemini Award-winning Canada, A People's History, both as a consultant and a special skills extra, but my bio doesn't say what those special skills are, and I'm quite curious. He is the author of the critically acclaimed If Ponies Rode Men, He lives in Hamilton, Ontario, 4 miles from the Stony Creek battlefield. And most recently, well, it's 2009, I don't actually know if that is the most recent publication. He has published Strange Fatality, The Battle of Stony Creek, 1813, with Robin Brass Studio. It's a compelling and well-researched reconstruction of one of the least understood actions of the War of 1812, but one that, in James's words, stemmed the tide of invasion. James.
Thank you. Good evening. Whose war was it? Good question. Let's see if we can honor it with a worthwhile answer. It's become a cliche of 1812 scholarship that neither one of the principals had much interest in claiming ownership outside of the national anthem, an essentially meaningless win in New Orleans, and some naval success. The Americans have little stomach for commemorating actions such as Detroit, which resulted in the largest territorial defeat ever inflicted on American arms, or largest territorial loss in American history, or beaver dams, perhaps the most decisive defeat ever inflicted on American arms by aboriginal forces. The British, for their part, had much larger fish to fry dealing with Napoleon, and for them the War of 1812 was, for the most part, an irritating sideshow to the main event in Europe. And not surprisingly, they're not keen on recalling disasters like Plattsburgh and New Orleans, or the loss of an entire Royal Navy squadron on Lake Erie, a singular event in British naval history. So much for the principals. The other players, the settlers of Upper and Lower Canada and the various Indian tribes that allied to the Crown, had a much more personal stake in the outcome of this war. Although the two Canadas were not the declared enemy in this conflict, they were the meat in the sandwich, so to speak, and the venue for most of the major battles. The heavy lifting was done by British regulars, with the citizenry and poorly trained militias supporting them with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Active service was an extreme hardship for pioneers trying to scrape a subsistence living from stump-ridden farms. A missed harvest or planting could be catastrophic for a family. Although settlers suffered at the hands of both armies, it was the Americans, by dint of having started the war, who engendered the most bitterness. By its end, many U.S.-born settlers, who had begun the war as lukewarm loyalists, had seen enough of what would become known as manifest destiny. The Canada's near-death experience during the War of 1812 would become the earliest impetus for political amalgamation, one that would culminate in Confederation half a century later. For the natives, however, the War of 1812 was not so much a beginning as an end. Tecumseh's grand vision of an Indian confederacy to resist American westward expansion died with him on the banks of the Thames in 1813. The British vow to gain its native allies, the buffer zone in the Great Northwest, died quietly early on in the peace negotiations at Ghent. So whose war was it? If the ownership criterion is who gained the most out of it, the answer is Canadians, for it was here that we experienced the first stirrings of nationhood. If the criterion is who paid the highest price, the only answer is the Shawnee, the Wea, the Kickapoo, the Potawatomi, and the 28 other nations that made up Tecumseh's Confederacy.
Thank you, James. Our next speaker is Jamie Swift. Jamie is the author of a dozen nonfiction books, including biographies of Eric Kearns and Bill Ryman. He's also written a best-selling sociology textbook. He's written examinations of Canadian forest policy, labor market inequality, and civil society. He is a longtime contributor to Ideas on CBC Radio, and he's written widely for publications from the Globe and Mail to Canadian Geographic and Harold Smith. He attended McGill University and lectures in the Queen's School of Business. He also works as a social justice advocate for the Sisters of Providence in Kingston. Jamie also, I'd written, has a new book coming out, but I see it's out there. So his new book is out, co-authored with Ian Mackay, also an historian at Queen's. It's entitled Warrior Nation, Rebranding Canada in an Age of Anxiety. And the work offers a critical perspective on the place of war in our current understandings of nationhood and citizenship. Jamie.
Thanks a lot. I have indeed spent the past 6 years writing this book with Ian Mackay, my friend who teaches history at Kingston, who's a prominent Canadian historian. I'm neither an historian nor terribly prominent. So what I'm really here to do is to situate this question of the War of 1812 in the context of this book, Warrior Nation. I'm also here to, because it's great to come to Kitchener. We started up our publishing company, Between the Lines, here in Kitchener 35 years ago. And there's several people in the room who were involved in that enterprise, and several other authors of BTL books here in the room. So welcome. You know who you are, the guilty parties. Warrior Nation explains the way that new warriors, a group of people that Ian and I call new warriors, are trying to rebrand Canada. And these new warriors include politicians, assorted militarists, and given the present context, not least historians. And we know who they are, I think. They want to reshape memory, and they want to reshape our self-understanding. And for the new warriors, Canada's history, Canada's landmark events were those in which the British and American empires were built and defended. And it's in the rush of soldiers to the defense of empire that Canadians should seek their national identity. Warrior Nation argues that Canada's stances on peace and war emerge from our history and our habits of remembering. And that's why the attempt to rebrand Canada as a warrior nation is so very important. Habits of the heart, if you will. The attempt to turn the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812 into a spasm of patriotic zeal fits right in with this Warrior Nation effort. It seems to be a priority for this government. Why else would a government that's willing to sacrifice Library and Archives Canada on the altar of austerity be willing to spend $28 million commemorating this senseless and bloody conflict? And I think, and Ian and I came to the conclusion, that the real reason they want to spend this money to commemorate this war is because it was a war. And that this government is interested in everything that has to do with war, authoritarianism, and hierarchy. I don't know how far $28 million would go to restore the funding that's been cut from Library and Archives Canada, or more appropriately here at a public library, how much of the public access program that allows poor people to get access to the internet at a public library, how much of that $28 million would help those poor people regain web access. I don't know. I do know we did figure out that it's enough to operate our recently eliminated Polar Environmental Atmospheric Research Laboratory for 18 years, which is a long time given the climate crisis. So Warrior Nation is all about the uses and abuses of history. History is contested terrain. And it's appropriate that our session today falls a week after the death of the great American intellectual Paul Fussell, whose book, The Great War and Modern Memory, inspired us and made this literary theorist into a public intellectual who really helped to define what it is to remember war. And Fussell explained that the drift of modern history does what he calls normalizes the unspeakable. And unlike Canada's new warriors, none of whom have ever experienced combat or war, Fussell recalls lying wounded in a field in southern France, being sprayed by a spray of blood, cloth, and tissue as one of his comrades took a heavy round to the chest. These are not the memories of war that our Prime Minister would like have us take away from the War of 1812. According to Stephen Harper, and I'm quoting here, the war helped to establish Canada's, quote, path toward becoming an independent and free country. The heroic efforts of Canadians helped to define who we are today, what side of the border we live on, and which flag we salute. Now, I'm not sure whether flag saluting is necessarily part of the Canadian political tradition unless we serve in the military. However, that's what Stephen Harper said. And it's very, very reflective of what Fussell calls the high diction that accompanies the rhetoric around war. And Harper said this, even though at that time there was no such thing as Canada, even though the famously undefended border has since become known as a security perimeter, that's another militarized term, and even though Canadians, as I said, are not necessarily too used to patriotic flag waving. So will Canadians be asked in this, what I call spasm of patriotic zeal that will cost us so much money, will we be asked to remember in the War of 1812 how profoundly the British double-crossed their principal and most important allies? Certainly Tecumseh will be treated as a hero, but then again, heroism is part of what Fussell described as the high diction of war. I think it's safe to say, if you want to get into this game, that Canada's First Nations people were the real losers, as James said. The real winner, I would say, was a man like Strawn, the famous family compact member who was a modest fellow. He wrote his own biography at the age of 22. After the War of 1812, and as James mentioned, the Treaty of Ghent, the British negotiators betrayed the native claims. First Nations people became known as wards of the state, not separate entities, and the dream of a native-controlled polity at the heart of North America, to which the British had given their tentative support, was gone for good. So yes, we should remember the War of 1812, but let's get beyond the priapic rock monument and great man symbols of history. I live in Kingston, and we're just gearing up now for a grand extravaganza to mark the 200th anniversary of John A. Macdonald. So we have that to look forward to. We also have something to look forward to that we should look out for. If they're doing this amount of propagandizing around the 200th anniversary of the War of 1812, what are they going to do about Vimy? What are they going to do about 1914 and that senseless slaughter? We can just keep that in mind. Let's recall what people like Paul Fussell and a man named Tiger Dunlop had to say about the war, about war. And these are the words of people who actually have experienced war. Dunlop was a prominent Upper Canadian politician and magistrate who was a battlefield surgeon during the War of 1812 and remembered the military incompetence of poorly planned deployments of men like himself. And he described it as one of the many blunders of this blundering war. In his 1847 memoir, Dunlop recalled treating the wounded, most often by amputation. He did his grisly work in the withering heat of the ramshackle Butler's Barracks down the Niagara River from Queenston Heights, and the flies landed on the open wounds and deposited their eggs so that by the time Dunlop got to them, the maggots had already been mobilized. He came across an elderly American farmer whose wife had helped him struggle across to the enemy side, seeking treatment under a flag of truce. And this man was either a militiaman or a camp follower. And his wife spoke to Dunlop as she held his head in her lap as he slowly expired. And these were her words, and I'll leave you with them, as recalled by Tiger Dunlop. And she said, "Oh, that the king and president were both here this moment to see the misery their quarrels lead to. They surely would never go to war without a cause that they could give as good a reason to God on the last day for thus destroying the creatures he has made in his own image." Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jamie. Our next speaker is Elsith Jones. Elsith is an associate professor in the Department of History at the University of Manitoba. And her research interests are many. They include health and disease in Canada and the modern world. They include 20th century health activism and politics, transnational social movements, working class history, and the history of Winnipeg. She is the co-editor with historian Adele Perry of the recently published People's Citizenship Guide, A Response to Conservative Canada. And the book is a direct response to that new pamphlet put out, Discover Canada, the Rights and Responsibilities of Citizenship, which has been widely critiqued on any number of grounds, particularly for its restrictive definition of Canadian identity. And the biggest difference between these two works is that Canada's colonial and liberal legacy is directly acknowledged in Elsith's work. Rather than taking Canada, for example, as an historical inevitability, where the only, quote, regrettable instances of social and ethnic conflict are excused away, the People's Citizen Guide more explicitly emphasizes that Canada is a construct, and I'm quoting here, Canada is a construct, a product of collective imagination and history that in the past and today has included some people while excluding some others. And Elsa, and we're ready for you.
Okay. At the beginning of our guide, which is a project that was constructed as an alternative to Discover Canada, we write, nations are complicated, and so are our feelings about them. So I want to talk a little bit about my feelings about Harper's notions of nationhood and identity and citizenship and our way of approaching or responding to them. And this project was put together by 11, mostly historians, but also legal scholars and economists, as a way of mobilizing our own understanding of what is at stake in documents like Discover Canada. Have any of you read Discover Canada? I recommend that you go. You can go and look at it online. You can look at it as a PDF, or you can read it as an ebook, or you can order a copy and the government will send it to you. In Discover Canada, the Harper government links notions of nationhood and identity and citizenship explicitly, as Jamie Swift says, to a celebration of armed conflict, including 1812. In Discover Canada, 1812 is referred to as the War for Canada, which is at best, I'm not myself a scholar of 1812, but I've listened to a number of people talk about it over the last few days from very different perspectives. You know, the description of it as the War for Canada is at best an anachronistic depiction of events, since there was no Canada in 1812, and at worst a misrepresentation or a distortion of historical fact, if you like. The narrative imposes a form of nationhood and unity, in fact, including unity with and between Indigenous peoples in this period and across region and across belief systems, gender and class, and a unity, of course, that you could quite easily doesn't exist. And this attempt to impose a certain kind of unified imagery and identity, which privileges war and a kind of uncritical or unthoughtful patriotism, of course, positions some of us as true Canadians and others as not true Canadians, depending on your willingness to embrace the Harper view of Canadian history. In my opinion, as Julia started out, these conversations are often about a sense of belonging, a sense of who's on the inside and who's on the outside. So these kinds of conversations are about drawing a line between those of us who are embraced by the category of Canadian and those of us who fall outside the definition of nation. But what I want to talk about is the fact that this process isn't just aimed at us, if we might say, as Canadians, those who were born here, or those who have become Canadians through the processes of citizenship tests and ceremonies, But also newcomers and prospective newcomers. This conversation is explicitly through citizenship study guides directed at newcomers, at people who seek to become newcomers to Canada. So what does the purpose, what purpose does the definition of Canadianness that Discover Canada contains, what purpose does that serve? And Discover Canada, like all state expressions of nationalism and civic identity, is a really fascinating document, of course. For me, and this is just, you know, one way of approaching the document, it's interesting not only because it puts a rosy face on Canada's colonial past and present, because that kind of over-optimism is probably not unexpected in a government publication, but more particularly because of the stance that the guide takes toward the immigrant, him or herself. So Jason Kenney preaches to the newcomer that Canadians must take responsibility for supporting their families. And the assumption implicit here is that immigrants, of course, don't know that. You know, in fact, one of the study questions is, what are examples of taking responsibility for yourself and your family? And this is a question that appears in a National Citizenship Study Guide. Discover Canada also at times seems to suggest that immigrants don't understand the nature of democracy or equality. Questions like, after an election, which party forms government? To me, really speak to this kind of sense that, you know, people have no tradition of democracy when they come here, that we have to, you know, educate the newcomer. This assumed ignorance acts as a way to position newcomers as a kind of blank slate. So historical subjects, like 1812, are mainly deployed in Discover Canada through this carefully constructed parochialism, which I don't think is really very harmless at all. Among other things, this approach ignores the wide array of political, ideological, religious, economic, and cultural experiences that immigrants have always carried with them in their migrations, and the many ways in which, of course, those ideas and experiences have shaped our own histories. In a way that I believe needs to be challenged, the newcomer is assumed to need a kind of unnuanced or unsophisticated history. While he or she is simultaneously being regaled with images of nationhood that public opinion polls in Canada would suggest are not really meaningful to most Canadians. The most obvious examples here are the role, the large role for the monarchy that Discover Canada emphasizes, as well as Canada's status as a constitutional monarchy as opposed to a democracy. In other words, even at the level of what constitutes history, there's one version for us and one version for them. And this is why when many of us rediscover Canada, we barely recognize the country it claims to describe. And I don't believe the idea here is inclusion, to include the newcomer. The idea more is that the onus is on you as the newcomer to accept this particular version of history, and also accept the notion that the immigrant must mold themselves as a blank slate into the Harperite image of Canadian history, which itself erases really any meaningful history of migration, of settlement, of colonialism, and of course of movements for democracy and justice. Harper's team has become quite skilled at deploying history in various of his attempts to polarize Canadian society, which I think is his larger project. You know, and I think what's his name at the Globe and Mail? His name I'm blanking on now. Jeffrey Simpson. Mm-hmm. Jeffrey Simpson agrees with me, so I guess I must be on to something. You know, he claims that, for example, his claims that the NDP, you know, didn't support the war against Hitler is a perfect example, mm-hmm. right, of the kind of use of history in a way that, on the one hand, you know, is a diversionary tactic, if you want to look at it that way. But it also has a kind of deeper meaning in messaging. Commemorations, such as the 1812 commemorations, of course, are another example of this deployment of history. Now, my view, of course, is not probably the view of everyone in this room. So I want to talk a little bit about what I think we've hoped to achieve with the Citizenship Guide in relation to what, you know, these problems that I've talked about. All of the 11 contributors to the guide really engage with Discover Canada in their own unique and individual ways, which is one of the nice things about this project is collaboration. But we set out not only to critique Harper, but to develop an alternative. And these are two very different projects, critiquing and developing alternatives. So the goal of this project, like that of other people's histories, alternatives, platforms, manifestos, or the we have an upcoming French language version of the guide, which will be called Manuel Populaire de Citoyenneté. It's to invite people to take ownership over their own sense of what our conversation about citizenship and immigration should sound like. So the point of the project has never been to suggest that this is the appropriate response to Discover Canada, or the only response to it, or the singular response, but rather to encourage debate and to encourage a lot of responses. And this conversation, I can say just from my limited experience working with people on this guide, it immediately becomes really interesting when you try to agree on what you might say about Canada as opposed to what you do not want to say about Canada. If you read our guide, you'll see that 1812 doesn't appear in it. Our section, I don't know, we have about, you know, 700 words to write the whole of history between, you know, the British conquest and Confederation. But partly we made this decision or this choice as a way of offsetting the emphasis on 1812 that's in Discover Canada, right? So it's meant to be a pretty kind of clear juxtaposition. But I'd be the first person to admit that that's not necessarily the best way to deal with the problem of 1812. So, you know, in this way, it leaves open the possibility for different sorts of ways of describing what was going on in 1812 and why it matters to us. So if we went in a slightly different direction and sat down together, say, to write 750 words about 1812, and maybe we meant these words to be read by a new migrant, say from Egypt, what would those words be, and how would we come to agreement about what those words would be? Would we rely on a historical expert, or would historical knowledge really only be one aspect of what was needed to agree on those? Would we try to relate to this newcomer through common histories of repression and war and democratic struggle? Could Indigenous and non-Indigenous find a common experience to reflect in a short description of this period in our history, or French and English? And that ideally is the open discussion that we're hoping to undertake with the what is now evolving into the People's Citizenship Guide project, with the help of people like Active History, who we're partnering with, and a series of community events that we're hoping to organize around the country in October during Citizenship Week and Citizenship Month, perhaps in October this fall. And to bring into conversation historians like myself and a concerned public for whom things like this history matters. So the notion of the people here is not meant to say that I have a right to say what constitutes the people's notion of citizenship any more than anyone else does. But it reflects a desire for a conversation. And the notion of the people also reflects the importance in our project of more than a generation of social history that attempts to privilege the lives of non-elite Canadians, and also to emphasize our common capacity to build a better democracy. So I hope that you'll visit, this is just the website for the publisher, but I hope you'll visit the Active History website over the months to come, and we're going to set up our own website. And if any of you have any interest in contributing a story about 1812, I'd be very happy to see it. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Elsa. Keith Jameson is our final speaker this evening. He's a Mohawk of the Six Nations of the Grand River, and he's worked extensively as an ethnohistorian, and he also works as a public historian, curating and interpreting his work for museum exhibits. He works as an adjunct professor and a guest lecturer internationally. He's also written and published exhibit catalogs, commentary for news media, and magazine articles. And this work is focused on people and on the history of the Six Nations, and particularly on the diplomatic relationships internationally. Keith also works to commemorate the War of 1812 within the history of the Six Nations Haudenosaunee people. He is particularly interested in commemorating 1812 as a time of divided loyalties for the people, as a time that fractured communities and relationships, and how do we go about commemorating those factors in the War of 1812, and as a war that called for reconciliation and community rebuilding in the war's aftermath. I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you. I'm telling you, Catherine, I'm the only Mohawk in the room, I think. And many people who still kind of dive under the table when I say that. But I'm not one of those Mohawks. What I want to do, and I've been thinking about it ever since Active History kind of approached me. I know Active History, the group. It was actually at Longyear, I think it was the sort of an inaugural event at York. And we had fun with that. And at that time, I had said something, and they've got it on the website, it's quoted on the website, which essentially was that it's our take, it is our understanding. We are positioned by and we position ourselves within the narratives of the past. That our current situation, we worry about how did we handle those things in the past that have confronted us or that we have had to adjust to. And we are a very adaptable group of people. We've changed tremendously and consistently, sometimes under intense pressure and an absolute demand that we do so. And we have always risen to that occasion. The interesting thing about the War of 1812, first and foremost, I think, is that it underscores the nature of battle as a not an isolated situation for us. It is the culmination of many other situations. This is just one more extension of situations that had gone on for 250 years prior to it. And we were fully aware of the people we were dealing with and some of the impacts that those things could have on us. And each time we would enter into it in some fashion or another, sometimes extremely reluctantly. The War of 1812 is a good example. We initially declared our neutrality at the outset of that war. This had nothing to do with us. As was the American Revolution, as was the Seven Years' War, these are not wars that were us. These are wars between French and English, two English brothers, that's how they defined the American Revolution. But they're always occurring in our backyard. And so what they saw was these two younger brothers who could not get along. And the only way that they could get along is if we separated them and we made them behave. And it worked, as did the War of 1812 in so many ways. That's an interesting one. Okay. But I want to tell you something else, and many people here are addressing it now. There is something about that war that's terribly, terribly important. For us, it is. And I'll tell it to you in the form of a story, okay? Because I'm good at stories. Mohawks are good at stories. When we set out on this, and I'm taking you back now to 2008, when we set out on, I was approached to do something with the legacy, with how do we commemorate this? Well, I'm 48. I don't know how do you commemorate people dying. So I worked it around for a while, and I participated and learned and taught myself more and more about it, because as many have already alluded to, there is precious little history that says anything about us. And what it does, it usually says Indians. Mm-hmm. The Indians. Mm-hmm. Well, who's that? Well, we're Haudenosaunee people. We are a group of people, a specific nation. And and they are Shawnees, they are a specific nation. And they ought to be acknowledged as such, but I'll get to that one. But at the start here, what I did was I convened a meeting within the community, and I invited a number of people to come, and I locked them into a basement, if I can. And I did, literally, I locked them into a basement of a small motel that operates in Six Nations, the village of Ashwini. And I said, nobody comes out of here until we know what we're talking about in terms of the War of 1812. What can we tell these people on the outside world about this whole thing? So we sat down, and went around the room several times. We had a number of the older guys. We don't really call them elders, per se. That really doesn't exist within the culture. It's a different kind of connotation for us. But the faith keepers and some of the peace chiefs and things like that. And people who have a long history of maintaining certain elements. And we locked them in the room, and they didn't create an agenda for them. I just said, we have to come up with four things that they have to be able to say that we can tell anybody, and it will be consistent, and anyone can deliver it, and that we can teach our kids, and that we can teach you their kids. So we went for about 6 hours. I fed them. I didn't start anybody. I brought in food. I didn't allow any cell phones, nothing like that. And at the end of the day, we had effectively done that. And they're here. There are copies of that material here at the end of that discussion. And the statement that remains a result. But off in the corner, there was an older gentleman who was sitting in the corner very quietly. Very occasionally he would say something, but it was very brief and often very limited. And he just listened through the whole afternoon, the whole day. And at the end of the day, when we had kind of come up with these things, I looked at him and I said, what is it you want? What do you see happening here? What is it you want to happen? And he surprised me with the simplicity of his response, was that I just want to see the war end. In other words, that war has never ended for us. The legacy of the War of 1812 for Six Nations and all First Nations in North America has been dismal at best. And he just said, if you can get this war to end, then you've achieved everything we need to achieve. Because he spent his life doing it and couldn't bring it to an end. And he saw this as an opportunity to address those kinds of things and to make sure that Canadian people and people in the U.S. and to remind the British that we have this relationship with them that goes all the way back to the 1660s. And it saved them. And this war was no different. Now, I'm really impressed by your other people because one of the major statements that they wanted to deal with here in anything that we undertook to projects or commemorations. And that's the other aspect of when I first brought them together, they were terribly reluctant to do so. The people at Six Nations were not jumping at the bit here to get into involved in anything to do with commemorating a particular conflict or war because it devastated them. They were killing each other, they were killing families. They saw it as, why are you going there? That was the response I got. I got it for about 16 months to start with the exercise. But eventually they saw the merit in it by doing something else, which is acknowledge the fact that the legacy of the War of 1812 for us has been equally as devastating for the last 200 years. What is the legacy that we are going to leave our children from this current effort? And that's actually a reason why I wanted to be here, because the active history approach to me is about how do we use this? What do we do with it? We know all about it. We can stick it in nice books, nice coffee table books, and we can do all these nice things and paintings and all that. Doesn't make any difference and it makes no sense if we can't learn, if we can't reposition ourselves relative to the narratives of the past. And in order for us to do that, we have to know what they are, because they have been effectively omitted and written out of official Canadian histories, if you want to call it. We are not there. We are just the Indians. The extension of that is what is there is horrific. It is usually inaccurate and incorrect. No one ever asked us what the story was. What is our story? We have never been asked that. So one of the major statements, one of the major efforts that they wanted to undertake by anything to do with a commemorative event, doesn't matter our level of participation. We wanted to achieve a legacy of respect through acknowledgement. Because one of the big issues that confront us now, and has in a very intense fashion sometimes, in fact, very confrontational and violent sometimes, in the last 6 years, is there is a total lack of respect for anything that we have done in this country, for this country, or that we are even a part of it. We are the immigrants. Now, the assumption that we have been, adequately looked after, that we stay on this little postage stamp size of land, and never to be seen or heard from. It is the fulfillment of another legacy, which is we were supposed to be. By virtue of sort of Darwinian theory of natural selection, we should be dead by now. We should be extinct. And you'd be terribly surprised when I do teach at places like Wilfrid Laurier or Western, how many people believe that, that we are extinct people. That we are but sort of this welfare situation constantly. We are not productive, we are not contributory. There's nothing in that that makes any sense at all. It is simply a result of a lack of respect and a lack of acknowledgement that we actually did this. One of the questions that we have, and it came up, and I'm sure you asked yourself the same question, it is kind of the same question, whose war was this anyway? Why a war? Why do people, and why is there wars declared? Like, why do we fight a war? Well, usually it's over land. Usually it's over like territory land. They're trying to control somebody else's territory. Or in the resources that are contained within it, thus the economy or the money that comes as a result of that. So it's either land or money. Finally, it is simply brutish power. It is this insatiable need for power and authority over whomever you are fighting. There's one element, though, that never gets discussed, and it is the element that we see that defines who won and who loses, which is that of honor. You enter a war, and I think that's the case with the War of 1812. It is a war about honor. There is a defense of a crown, and there's the defense of a revolutionary country. But in the end, nothing happens. Nothing changes. There's no change in land. There's no change in any of those things. It is simply the honor of it. And in that instance, we win. Because we lived up to our honor. We lived up to our responsibility and obligation, whether we wanted to or not. And we defended the crown, and we defended the Americans. Because you've got to remember, the divided loyalties thing is right there, which is, after the American Revolution, we had an alliance with the British, the king, but we had a new one, and that was with the American president. And we felt that that would keep everybody at bay, too. In the end, it didn't. In the end, their interests were never honored. And they still aren't. Because at the end of the war, in 1815, and that to me is the most telling element of the
this whole thing. We can talk about the wars, the battles, and the battles and skirmishes and all that sort of thing. I heard numerous sites across Ontario and the U.S. side. But that's not the issue. The issue is what is the end result? What's the end game here? And the end game was for us, the Crown rep, came to us and called us together, and he presented us with a promise from the Crown in 1815. In April of 1815. And that promise was that everything that was ours before 1811 would be restored to us. And no one would ever interfere with us ever again. That lasted about 5 years. Someone told me where the honor is in that. There isn't any. And we have maintained, not so much lately, I got to agree. You know, that seam is bursting in many instances. The younger generation, not mine so much. I was kind of bad too, but not like this. They are much more aggressive and much more assertive about who they believe they are and what they are entitled to, if you want to put it that way. I've heard a lot of things said about rights. You know what? At home, I'll tell you another story about that one too. Rights. They don't have that word. There is no Mohawk word, no Cuba word, no word in Six Nations languages, or Anishinaabeg languages at all for the word right. We don't have rights. All we have as a people are responsibilities and obligations to other people and to all things around us. That's all we have. And we fail to meet our responsibilities and obligations, and we fail to benefit from what's around us. That's how they define it. So it's really kind of an interesting little scenario that gets created here. The divided loyalties was overridden because of the keen sense of responsibility and obligation to their alliances. And they met them. Much to their own destruction in many instances. So you have those things, and people need desperately to understand them. And by virtue of many of the speeches that I just heard here in the presentation, That's starting to echo for me. Like, you guys are saying it. and I'm terribly glad you were, because, 10 years ago, I doubt if that same discussion would occur. It's only now that it is. I think it's only now that Canadians are beginning to kind of critically think, what kind of history are they being fed here? Think about what you're being taught. What's the purpose? Why are we being taught a history which totally omits an entire race of people? I don't understand that. And it is our objective as a group to make sure that that does not happen any longer, that we begin to address those kinds of things. One last thing I do want to, that I want to say, and I'll leave it here, is that the enduring element of all of what I'm driving at here is really the legacy of propaganda that has haunted us for centuries about First Nations. When you see in the history books that men, sort of British and settlers, won a battle, it was a great victory. It was when we win, it was a massacre. We were brutal. We were savage. We are cowards, and we are all these things. And yet today, like, we use guerrilla warfare on a regular basis. Where do you think that comes from? That's how we fought. They say we fought from the trees. That's how they say. We didn't stand out in the middle of a field and face somebody. One guy's got a red blazing red jacket on, the other guy's got a deep blue jacket on. They're 100 yards apart and they shoot each other. And whoever's left standing, I guess, wins the particular battle. That made no sense to the warriors at home. Why, these people are nuts. Let's wait. Let's wait, because they'll eventually just kill each other. And they did. So those things, the propaganda issues, are the most contemporary ones in the people's specific attention at
that is propaganda that continues today. The fight for Canada is one such piece of propaganda. In that we were allies, that's totally protected, but we had a much greater stake in this particular battle. That's what we were fighting for. It had little to do with the Canada or the U.S. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a recording of The War of 1812, Whose War Was It Anyways? A roundtable discussion. You can find recordings of other talks on activehistory.ca.